I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 16 of Season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Nick Rehak of the Rabbit Hole Podcast. Welcome back to the show, Nick.
Thank you for having me back.
I always love having you as a guest, especially because most of the time you haven't seen these movies yet. And like, I'm getting the first impression. Is A Wonderful Life one of those?
It sure is.
No, I don't mind. I don't mind recommending movies, and hopefully you like them, you know. So why don't you give me a general perspective of what you thought of this movie, since you said you'd never seen it before. Like, what's your history with this movie?
The history, I'd always wanted to see it. I just never really sat down and watched it. I have family members, both blood and in-law family members, that really, really enjoy this movie. And they've always kind of dogged me a little bit. Like, come on, you know, you say you're a movie fan and you haven't seen this. I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm aware.
You're saying, you said I'm waiting for Rob to do it as minute by minute, and then I'll
yeah. That's what I should have said.
That should be your standard answer.
Well, if we wait anytime. A little bit.
There you go. That's your standard answer from now on. There you go.
I like that. I'm going to start using that. Then, you know, you reached out and I decided to watch it, and I was completely blown away by this movie. I was not expecting it to be the way it was at all. I don't even know what preconceived notion I had in my head, but this was a total 180 from anything that I could have guessed. A couple things made context from like other pop culture film or films referencing this, like pop culture references of this film. A lot of things clicked, which I thought was pretty cool. And overall, I absolutely loved it. It's beautiful. It's devastating at times. It's just such an emotional journey for a film from the 40s that I was not expecting. Like, it is such a surprising movie as well. And I can't wait to throw this into the yearly rotation and just enjoy it year after year. And maybe I'll take away different lessons from it as I get older. But I mean, I would just move to tears. I hope I don't tear up during these episodes, because it'll be a little embarrassing.
No, that'll be fine. You will not be the first, then you will not be the last. So okay. You're okay.
Well, good. Okay, good.
I've already been told by a few of my future guests that you know, the odds of them crying are very high as we're just talking about it. So we'll have to wait and see.
And the episodes, the minutes you have picked out this week. Wow, that was we'll get to it, but it's gonna be real touch and go.
Yeah, especially when you know what's going to happen. That's the thing. That's where it comes from. You know, that's what this is a week for. I mean, I'm assuming that most people who are listening to this have already seen the movie. Okay, but if you haven't, so slight spoiler here. If you've seen the movie or the first time watching this movie, you don't necessarily get the poignancy of this scene until you see the second time and you already know what's going to happen. You know, and then it like jumps at you and you're like, oh, wait a second. I can't believe they just did that. You know, and it's just great. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here. So we have a week to discuss this. So minute 16 begins with Harry playing around and ends with Harry asking a question. So we ended things on Friday with a big romp within the Bailey household. You know, you have Harry and George. And then you have Peter and Ma Bailey. I don't think we ever find out her first name. You know, his first name is Peter Bailey. But I think she's just known as Mother or Ma or Mom the whole time. And Annie and their dog, for some reason, you know, who's slightly here. You know, we don't see the dog that much, but the dog is there too. So it's the whole family getting together. You know, on Friday they were making a lot of noise upstairs. And then, you know, Harry and George came down, and, you know, the minute ended on Friday with Harry basically saying, well, I don't care. It's George's ducks. Meaning, I'll get it ruined. Who cares? Not my problem. And then he basically immediately starts to harass Annie, you know, who's the housekeeper, you know, and he goes, Annie, my sweet, have you got those pies? And he starts like chasing her around the table. You know, like the atmosphere in the Bailey household is quite laid back, you know,
Very jovial.
Yes. Very jovial. And everyone is really comfortable with one another, with the various things that they say and do and stuff like that. You know, no one really gets offended. You know, I mean, come on, Harry starts chasing the housekeeper around the table and even like gives her a little slap on the rear as he's like running around.
She's got like a broom. Like,
and she's got a broom. Shoo him away. And she says, if you lay a hand on me, I'll hit you with this broom. And then Harry goes, Annie, I'm in love with you. There's a moon out tonight. Now, I don't know what he's trying to say there. Is he saying that he's a werewolf? I mean, like, what's the big deal about there being a moon
out? That's kind of what I got. That's kind of the vibe I got. Like, I'm a wolf in sheep's clothing kind of thing. Like, I'll show you a real good time, but without, like, being, I guess, for the time, so vulgar as to say it.
Right. But I think it's more, I don't know. I was thinking of the song, you know, That's Amore.
Oh, okay.
Where he's basically saying, I'm in love with you. So he's talking about the, you know, the moon. If you look at the lyrics of it. You know, if you, I mean, you're a music guy. Yeah. You must know the lyrics of it.
Well versed in Dean Martin.
Okay. So where do you think lyrics would fit in here?
Well, I mean, I think it's just it when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, around asking for pies. Now, granted, it's the dessert that's type, right. But it's a pie nonetheless.
That's right. And he's basically saying that's amore. There you go. You know, so it could be that is. I mean, obviously, the song That's Amore, from what I understand. Only came out in 1953. So maybe Dean Martin got the idea of it from this movie.
Wouldn't that be something?
You know, maybe you heard Harry say, you know, there's a moon out tonight and I'm in love with you. And he was like, oh, wow, what a great idea. Let's just think about that. Love, amore, a pie, the moon. Hey, yeah. Who knows?
Later on in the song, they're talking about bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling. And obviously bells are ringing in this one. They talk about dancing down the street. There is dancing. And there is dancing in the street in this film. There's a little talk about, like, you know, dream world and that kind of thing. But it all makes sense to me. I like this theory. I really like this.
Yeah. Well, come on. When I have Nick on, I got to talk about music. I know how it works.
It works.
You know, just like if you were to have me on a show that you're talking about music, you'd have to, you know, bring in movies. That's what it comes down to.
That's very true.
You know, we all have our specialities, you know, I definitely am not a musical specialist like you are. And you see, you get both. You've got music and movies. So that works really well.
Hands in multiple cookie jars.
That's right. That's right. Cookie. Maybe.
You never know.
That's right. Just don't get caught.
That's true. That is true.
That's what it comes down to. That's the trick. Don't get your hand caught in the cookie jar. And then, like, Annie screams as she's, you know, moving into the kitchen, you know, as he's, you know, running after her. You know, and then we see Ma Bailey finally sitting down at the table. And then we hear George say something really strange. He goes, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. My last meal in the old Bailey boarding house. Now, do you think that that they really are running a boarding house? Or is it the idea that you know, is he just using that as a phrase?
I think he's just using it as a phrase. And that line did throw me when I first heard it. I'm like, wait a second. I thought, but I think it's just one of those, you know, like my wife and I own our house and we pay a mortgage, but I just joke around. I call it the rent. It's something like that. Something just to kind of mix it up and be a little bit different. And the way they are in the house, like, you know, people kind of coming and going in the moment and, you know, very light and jovial and stuff. It could feel like, you know, a handful of people in a house at once. And there's a grand familiarity there, but I think it's just like a passing phrase kind of thing that not many people say anymore.
Okay, well, the reason I asked the question is because it's very strange that in the alternate world that'll happen, you know, towards the end of the movie, so Ma Bailey is running a boarding house. Huh. Okay, because George comes to her door and it says on that Bailey boarding house. But if you look at their table and you look at the way that the living room is set up, that's not a boarding house. You know, a boarding house is like what we would see in Groundhog Day, you know, where you have like a communal dining area for everyone, you know, the family and the guests and all that stuff. Yeah. And you don't see that here. Like the table that they have here is not big enough for guests and things like that. And I even saw that it was written somewhere, you know, when it was talking about this movie, how it says that the Baileys owned a boarding house, but there is no evidence of that besides this phrase. And later on, you know, having Ma Bailey in the alternate world running a boarding house. So I think it is a joke. That's my understanding of this.
Huh. Okay.
That, you know, that it's not a boarding house and that, you know, he's just calling it a boarding house because basically I guess George is sort of saying that this is a transient stop for me. You know, I'm moving on. And that's what a boarding house is.
That makes a lot of sense. I like that.
You know, that's my interpretation of it. Now, do you know the actual definition of a boarding house?
I would assume something similar in line to like a dormitory.
Okay. So it is and it isn't. I mean, what it basically is, it's a family home where they have lodgers who rent one or more rooms on a nightly basis and sometimes for extended periods of weeks, months, or years. They have the common parts of the house that are maintained and some services such as laundry and cleaning may be supplied, and they normally provide room and board. So therefore, there are meals as well as having accommodations. So another good example of this is Forrest Gump. You know, his mother had a boarding house.
Okay.
That's how we met Elvis. Elvis was staying in the boarding house.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. You know? Yeah.
And when do you think they started establishing boarding houses in the U.S.?
I would say post-Civil War, let's say 1880s.
Well, actually, it started in 1830s in Boston.
Okay, missed it by a couple of years.
Yeah, just a few.
One or two.
That's right. And basically, they would have like, you know, businessmen or laborers, you know, people just passing through would stop off and they would stay at places and stuff like that. In the late 1860s, you know, after the Civil War, So most places, depending on where you were, the prices ranged between $2.50 to $40 a week.
Wow, that's a gap. $2, $2.50 to $40.
Yeah. Well, again, it probably depends on where you are. I'm assuming if you're in New York City or in Boston, you know, in the middle of the city, it's going to cost you more than it's going to cost you in a boarding house in Louisiana.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the idea of it, and basically. You know, in the after the Depression, they became less common. They still were around. And then in the 50s, they were pretty much non-existent. There were some places that had it. And by the 60s, you really couldn't find them. You know, I'm assuming that nowadays you still can find some.
Well, it's just called Airbnb.
But it's a little different because in an Airbnb, you generally don't have communal meals, do you?
That's true. That is true. Unless... I mean, there's been some B&Bs that we've stayed at where the homeowner has like offered and we were like, oh, you know, no, that's OK thing.
No, they've offered to bring you a meal or they offered for you to come down to the quote unquote dining room and have a meal.
Go down to the dining room and have a meal with them.
Oh, really? Yeah. OK, so I guess so. OK.
But it also depends. Again, like that was the Midwest reference. Where people are a little friendlier than necessarily the city folk.
Right. Okay, I mean, it goes back to Punxsutawney, PA, you know, so,
exactly.
You know, there they did have a dining room, and I mean, again, it has been 30 years, but still, you know, it you can, I guess, base it on that type of thing. So, yeah, I guess you could say that B&Bs are close to that, you know, from the perspective that back in the day, that was the staple, that you would have meals and you would have communal areas and stuff like that, and nowadays... It's the exception, not the rule.
Yes.
You know, it's the places that you can get them. Mm-hmm. If you look at popular culture, I mean, Sherlock Holmes lived in a boarding house. You know, he had a landlady who was who would you know, make meals for him and do his laundry and stuff like that.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, because like it wasn't like it was his spot because of the
In True Grit, there's a boarding house.
Oh wow.
That's
okay.
Where basically he's staying through this. And then if you want to start getting into movies, wow, there's so many of them. You have the Lodger, which was if I remember correctly, one of The Lodger was a Hitchcock movie, I believe, from 1927. And then you have Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde has a boarding house in it. Stage Door has one. Citizen Kane, his parents owned a boarding house. Yankee Doodle Dandy, so George M. Cohan stays in a boarding house.
It's a lot more common back then than I realize now that you're giving me all these examples.
That's right. What else? You have, well, The Shootist, which, you know, another, that was John Wayne's final movie where he was, you know, renting in a boarding house. In the movie Brooklyn, you know,
the
Oscar nominated. Yeah. From I think it was like 2015, I think, if I remember correctly.
Sure.
So she stays in a boarding house there also.
Which makes sense given.
So yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of examples of it. In the Andy Griffith Show, Barney Fife lived in a boarding house.
I wonder why they're not more common.
I don't know. That I couldn't answer.
Because you would think they're so prevalent, and then it just kind of goes away. You think that,
That's
something to think about.
Yeah, no, I know. You think about that. You think about that, and let me know about that.
Tomorrow. I will.
and then Ma Bailey gives a very strange response to George, and she goes, "Oh my lands, my blood pressure." So have you ever heard the phrase my lands?
No, I've heard, oh, my Lanta, but I've never heard my lands.
So it basically it means an expression of surprise or dismay. It says that it is dated and rustic. So, you know, I guess people don't say that anymore.
Not really.
And then my blood pressure. So, you know, I guess she, you know, she's sitting down. It's somewhat ironic that she's complaining about her blood pressure at this point. Mm. You know, of the inhabitants of the room, you know, and, you know, then we have Harry stick his head out from the kitchen door and he goes, Pop, can I have the car? I got to take over a lot of plates and things. And then Ma Bailey says, what plates? He goes, Mom, I'm the chairman of the Eats Committee. We only need a couple of dozen. Now, this always makes me laugh, this whole thing. Now, first of all, have you ever heard of an Eats Commission or a Eats Committee?
I haven't, and it threw me off, and I had to rewind it twice with the subtitles on in order to catch what he said to make sure that I heard what he was saying and it wasn't like an audio glitch or something weird.
And it was very strange for me to hear. And I searched for much too long to find out about an Eats Committee. And I couldn't find anything for it.
Really?
So I can't tell you what it is. Yeah. I mean, obviously it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It you know, what he's basically saying is he's in charge of everything dealing with the food at the, you know, whether this is a homecoming dance or the prom or just an end of the year dance or whatever it is, he's the one in charge of everything dealing with the food. But it's just funny that they would call it the Eats Committee. As opposed to, you know, the, I don't know, the food committee or, you know, I'm in charge of refreshments. You know, there's so many other types of phrases that could be used instead.
Yeah, he could have just said, I'm in charge of the food tonight, and that would have sufficed.
That's right. Yeah, and don't you think she would have known about this beforehand? You know, like, why he's only telling her now is he's about to leave that I'm in charge of the food.
Yeah, especially because when he walks out,
I mean, they made pies.
Yeah, he walks out with a couple of them. It's not just like, oh, I guess here's like a part of one or one that we, you know, we're going to eat later. Instead, he's got a couple.
That's right. He takes three pies with him, which we'll get to in a little bit. But and then he says he needs only a couple of dozen plates. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't have a couple of dozen spare plates in my house.
I have maybe a dozen plates a lot. In my house. I think that's how many.
But I'm talking. He's talking about spare ones, which is very strange.
Well,
you know, again, if we go back to what we're saying about that this is a boarding house, then it would make sense that they'd have it.
And not only that. Core of the house, whenever it cuts to kind of from Paul looking towards James Stewart's character, she has decorative plates like hanging on the walls. You can see a couple of them. So maybe she's like a plate person. Like I collect plates.
Yeah. I don't think those are the ones she would give him to take. That's true. you know, to the dance.
That is true.
You know, and I mean, they only have the truth is the plates on the table. They have, you know, they are decorative plates also, what they're using to eat off of. Yeah, they're not just standard white plates or something like that. You can see that they have a design on them. I mean, because it's black and white, it's a little difficult to tell what color it is, but yeah. But they also give us a great view of the entire, like, background of the room.
Yeah.
You know, where they have all these different antique things sitting on shelves. You know, they have even... They have like photographs, you know, picture frames, small picture frames, stuff like that, which we'll never know who these people are.
No.
You know, it could be their great grandparents or it could be even, you know, Ma and Pa Bailey when they were younger.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. Could be something. You know,
it's too far away. But the way that they do it is works really well because it gives more life to this house.
Yes.
You know, whoever did the production design said, okay, you know what, we're going to put all these things here and make this seem like this is someone's house.
It feels lived in. Like, in no way does it feel like a set piece in a studio.
Correct. Correct. So Ma Bailey then responds, oh, no, you don't, Harry. Now, not my best Havilid, no. Do you know what a Havilid is?
I would assume that it's a type of serving dish. But that's like the brand of it. Like it's called a Havilid or a whatever.
Oh, okay. Well, a Havilid is a brand name of porcelain.
Okay, close.
It's French. It's a French company that made porcelain that they started making it in the 1840s. And then in the late 19th century, that's when there was so much, so many people in America that were using Havilid designed porcelain. And they had different types of ceramics and stuff like that.
Okay.
Because what it says here, it says is that it's manufactured in France, but the company was created by an American named David Havilland.
Huh. Maybe it's one of those who was an importer where, exporter. See, that's what it is. When you import it and you say it's like French, oh, it's exotic. You know, I should buy more or I should, you know, pay for this versus a regular kind of one. I think it's all just in the branding.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, basically, it's a brand of porcelain, but it isn't necessarily, you know, he was bringing stuff in from France and also from England. And, you know, I guess that's just they're considered, you know, his brand.
There you go.
Because of that. Basically, he decided that he wasn't going to he didn't need to open a new factory because he can just, you know, bring the he just import it all himself.
Yeah. It's kind of like a reverse Amazon in a way.
Yeah. That actually, oh, wow. That's a really cool idea, reverse Amazon.
He's bringing it in because now Amazon, they bring stuff in, figure out how to make it, and then they just start selling their own version of it. Whereas him, he could, but he just kind of brings it in and then slaps the name on it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. George and Peter have already started eating. Yeah, you know, they're not waiting for everybody else. They're sitting there just eating. And George goes, let him have the plates, mother. I mean, the whole atmosphere, especially, it'll be over the next few days that we're going to talk about this. But the atmosphere between George and Peter is perfect.
Yes.
You know, they really give us the impression that this is a father and son who get along really well. And, you know, they don't need to look at each other when they're talking. You know, it's normal table conversation, and it works really well. It comes across really believable that the two of them have a very strong bond and strong connection.
So strong that
which
they'll talk with food in their mouths, which really bothered me.
Yeah, wait, one second. When you're having a meal with your family, you won't talk with food in your mouth?
I'll wait. I'll get a couple bites down.
No, but I'm saying with people that you're comfortable with.
Oh, even people I'm comfortable with, I'll get a couple bites down before I go to – I won't just shovel in and start talking like he does in this. I'm like, take a couple bites, man. Let's get some separation.
Wait a second. If you and Bethany are sitting there just having a meal by yourselves and you're eating, you're not gonna say something while you have food in your mouth? That's what you're telling
me? Not when I have food in my mouth, no.
You have much more manners than most people.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something about it. I can't do it. I gotta chew.
Chew away. Why not? And then the conversation changes a little bit, and Peter basically says to George, "Hope you have a good trip, George. Uncle Billy and I are gonna miss you." And he goes, "I'm gonna miss you too, Pop." And I mean, first of all, I love the way that, like I said, that this conversation just flows really well as they're having this. You know, he's just bringing it up out of more or less out of nowhere, because you know he knows that George is finally going to be leaving. So, you know, but they do a great job of exposition here, because this is basically telling us, you know, that George has been working for them. Mm-hmm. You know, no one ever mentions this before. I mean, we know that this is 1928, okay, and George was born in 1907, so therefore George is 21. Okay, so he must have graduated 2 or 3 years earlier, mm-hmm. and so he's been working during that time for Billy and Peter.
Yeah, and he's put the time in and established himself enough to where he's become a part of the business, like a legitimate part of the business.
Yes, for sure. And then George looks over at his father and goes, "Hey, what's the matter? You look tired." And the answer is, "Oh, I had another tussle with Potter today. I thought when we put him on the board of directors, he'd ease up on us a little bit." Now, have you ever heard the word tussle before?
Yes.
Really? Yes.
Grandmother said it a whole bunch for some reason. And then my father, her son,
while she was watching Die Hard movies with you?
No, the other one, my other grandmother.
Or a different grandmother. Oh,
yeah, the one on on my father's side, she would use that for, and I don't know why. She said a lot of, like, not offbeat phrases, but things that you wouldn't hear, like, so much. And I always found that endearing.
So what is a tussle?
A tussle,
based on your recollection from grandmama. React.
It's like a step or two above an argument. Maybe it comes to blows, maybe it doesn't, but it's kind of a heated argument.
I mean, that would be interesting to see Peter Bailey and Potter having a fist fight.
Yeah, I think Peter would take out Potter big time.
Well, because Potter can't get up.
That's why.
But then again, I have a theory that Potter is faking it. You know, so.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Because if you go back 2 weeks when Potter is shown in the building and loan, mm-hmm. so we don't see an elevator. So how did he get up the steps?
Oh, okay.
You know, like maybe he like puts the wheelchair at the edge of the stairs, looks around, make sure no one's looking, and then runs up the stairs. And then his servant man brings the wheelchair up next to him.
That is true.
Yeah, no, it makes you every time that the Potter is in the building alone, it always makes me wonder how he got there. I guess there theoretically must be an elevator somewhere, but not in plain sight.
Right.
You know, or maybe he has a magic wheelchair that has that can like levitate or something like that.
Could be super magic.
That's right. It would make sense. It's Potter. Come on.
It's true.
Hence the name. I mean, come on. He's no muggle. His name is Potter.
I like that. I'm going to pretend he's magic now. Like, for sure.
There you go. Why not? What do you mean? Why pretend? he's got magic spells. Who do you think maybe brought Clarence around, you know?
Ooh, this is turning into a whole new movie, man. I like this.
That's right. He conjured up Clarence in order to get George to not commit suicide, because he wants George to go to jail. Because if he dies, then it doesn't help him.
Yeah.
Ah, you see.
You've seen this movie a couple times, haven't you?
Yeah, just a few. But you're part of the Rabbit Hole podcast, and I like to go down rabbit holes.
I enjoy it very much.
Exactly. And, you know, so, I mean, it's pretty funny that Peter actually believes that if they put him on the board of directors, it would help.
Yeah, I didn't.
You know, you'd think that he would be a little smarter about that.
Yeah, I didn't really understand it. And I guess they thought maybe in their minds, oh, it's, you know, the devil you know, or the old Godfather, you know, friends close, enemies closer kind of thing. But didn't really work out like he thought he would.
No, not at all. And I mean, we'll see later how that plays out also. And then George asks a really interesting question. He goes, well, what's eating that old money-grubbing buzzard anyway? You know, and you'd think that at this point, George would already know the answer to that. George has been dealing with this for 9 years, mm-hmm. You know, ever since he was 12, when he first encountered Potter, or when we first encountered him with Potter, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just very strange. And then Peter just explains it to him and says, oh, he's a sick man, frustrated, sick in his mind, sick in his soul, if he even has one. He hates everybody that has anything he can't have. He hates us mostly, I guess. Yeah, that's actually giving a lot more credit to the Bailey building and loan than maybe they should have.
Well,
you know, for him saying that he mostly hates us.
When he said that, I looked at it as he hates us, as in he hates the family. He hates this family, you know, unit, two loving sons that are doing well for themselves, like that kind of like joviality and happiness that they have there. And I read it as that. It's like, that's what he doesn't have. He doesn't have that sense of family, someone to come home to, that, you know, love. And that's why he's the way he is.
Okay. All right. That actually makes sense also. Because I was thinking more from the business perspective, you know, that because he can't have the building and loan. He wants the building and loan. He wants to take over. He wants to be in control of taking care of dealing with everything. You know, and, you know, later on in the movie, when he takes over the bank. So then he says, okay, you know, the building and loan is the only thing he can't get his hands on. So, I mean, this is in some ways foreshadowing that also.
I like it.
Yeah. Okay, you can look at it both ways, I guess. But what's nice to see here is that Peter Bailey really understands who Potter is and what he stands for. And I think that's great. You know, and he's telling us and telling George at the same time that this is just a frustrated old man.
Mm-hmm.
He's only acting this way because he can act this way, because he basically doesn't have a soul.
Yeah.
And at the very moment that he says that, and then Harry comes out from the kitchen, he's carrying three pies, you know, one in each hand and one on his head. He goes, gangway, gangway, so long, Pop. And he goes, so long. And then George turns to Harry and goes, you got a match? Which is a little funny. And he goes, very funny, very funny. Bailey says to him, put those things in the car, and I'll get your tie and studs ready for you. Now hurry up. Okay, Mom. Now don't drop one of those things. And then Harry turns to George and says, you coming later? So, I mean, it's funny that she says that she'll get his ties and studs together.
He don't even care.
You know, the...
He's just waiting for her to kind of stop so he can ask his question of what he's focused on. He's like, yeah, Mom, that's fine. Whatever, that's sure.
That's right. When we're talking about studs, do you think they're talking about, like, you know, things that go over the buttons? You know, you have like the, when you have a tuxedo, you can also get like
cufflinks.
I guess they're called studs. Cufflinks, if you look at his shirt is already closed with cufflinks. So I think that the whole idea of a stud is it's something that is used to, you know, it fits. A shirt stud is a decorative fastener that fits into a buttonhole on the front of a pleated shirt.
Huh, okay.
And they have special buttonholes solely for shirt studs. You know, so you don't see the button, you just see the different metal or gemstone or whatever it is that they have there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's pretty much everything I have for this minute. Did you have anything else for this minute?
The only other thing I had for this minute was I was just fascinated by the way he carries pies. And I thought the pinned butterflies on the wall behind Peter were interesting. I feel like that's not something that we really see anymore, is like insects kind of pegged onto little boards like that in a scientific-esque manner.
Okay, that's actually very cool. I actually did a little bit of research on that, but I passed over it. I said, nah, we're not going to need it. It's not a big deal. But since you brought it up, do you know what it's called? Do you know what you would call someone who collects butterflies?
So part of me deep down inside was hoping that you had researched this, so I did not look it up. I'm excited to know what it is.
So the person is called a lepidopterist.
Okay. Not expecting that word, but okay.
That's right. Which basically it comes from the ancient Greek, and it basically means a scale and wing.
Oh, okay.
So I guess it's people who study, you know, different types of moths and the different families of the butterfly. And stuff like that.
So I guess they use it to kind of.
I mean, if you want, I can give you the history. I can give you a history of lepidopteristy.
I'm here for it. Like I'm not going anywhere.
When did people start studying butterflies?
Oh, it's got to be probably 1600s. Let's go with 1630s.
Oh, wow. That's great. 1634.
Get out of here.
That's right. 1634 is one of the first major works of someone about butterflies. A man named Thomas Moffat. I'm not even going to try and read the name of the article or book or whatever it was that he wrote because it's in Latin. Mm-hmm. Insectarum sive minimorium animalium theatrum. I don't know what that means, but it goes back quite far.
Okay.
Relatively speaking. And during between 1758 and 1900, there were a lot of people who dealt with these things. Again, I have the whole history here, but I don't think we're going to go through the entire history. I mean, I have even a list of nodal lepidopterists.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, and nowadays, they're the people who buy up basically things that are on the wall in the Bailey household.
Oh, okay.
You know, because it's rare that people do that anymore.
Huh.
And they have all these lepidoptical societies. Okay, I have a list here of 10 modern societies that still deal with it. And then there are four journals that deal with research in lepidopterological journals. Wow, that's definitely a tongue twister.
That it really is.
To talk about that one. Yeah.
Lepidopteran Weekly.
Yeah, see, there you go. No, it's the – okay, there's only four of them. So the Journal of Research on Lepidoptera. Then there's another one called Metamorphosis. Then the Taxonomical Report and Nota Lepidopterologica. So, yeah, if anyone's interested reading more about trapping butterflies and putting them on your wall – go look this up.
I feel like Metamorphosis is the one to go to because it's just a normal name. It's nothing crazy. There's no Latin to it. It's just like, hey, we all know what this word means, so come on and join us.
That's right. It's not as scientific as the others.
Yeah.
It's possible. It's definitely possible. Every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra films. Have you seen five Frank Capra movies?
So I have not. I've seen one, and this is it.
You've seen one.
But if it's okay, I tweaked it a little bit, and I just did five anticipated Capra films. These are five films of his that I really want to see.
Okay. Okay. That would be good.
We have It Happened One Night. I know that is one of three films that have taken the big five at the Oscars, so that's – I have to see that.
That's right.
I'd like to see Mr. Deeds Goes to Town because apparently the Adam Sandler film Mr. Deeds is based off of that movie. So you can't take it with you.
So you've theoretically already seen it.
To an extent, but I want to see if the original is better or at least what the humor would be. I'd like to see right. You Can't Take It With You because I feel like I've heard that before. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, because I hear about that one like all the time. And then
Have you seen the Eddie Murphy? Have you seen the Eddie Murphy remake of that?
I have not.
It's called The Distinguished Gentleman. That's the name of it. It's the Eddie Murphy film. The Eddie Murphy remake of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is The Distinguished Gentleman from 1992.
Okay.
Which is a fun movie.
I'll have to look that up then. I'll do that one. Mm-hmm. And then the fifth one would be Meet John Doe. I don't know what.
Wait, what about where would you put It's a Wonderful Life then?
Well, I guess I would put it on the list.
Oh, you're saying it's not fair to put it in
there. Yeah, because I've now seen it, so it's. Although anticipated, I'd be seeing it again in Christmas time, so I am looking forward to seeing it again. But as far as new watches, those are the five.
Okay, all right, that's fair. All right, so Nick, you want to tell people where they can find Nick Rehak?
Absolutely. They could find me over at rabbitholepodcasts.com. There's a myriad of podcasts over there, and I'm fortunate enough to be a part of two of them. One of them is called Lyrical Innuendo. Bubba Wheat and myself take a deep dive into the lyrics of popular music. We pull throughout history, and we analyze whether they're about sex, drugs, just good old-fashioned rock and roll. And then a newer project, Jason Soto is a hardcore Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan, and I have never seen an episode. So rather than say, hey, here's a couple of my favorites, instead he turned it into a podcast, and we're watching every single episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and you can tune into that show. It's called Play MST for Me.
Wow. All right, enjoy that one.
I'm so far so good. I'm having a fun time.
All right. Isn't that the important thing here?
It's the most. That's why I keep coming back.
That's right. Oh, you're talking about here. Mm-hmm. I was talking about Mystery Science Theater, but yeah, it's great that that's why I like having you come back here too. I always have a fun time with you, Nick.
Thank you.
Even when it's not in person. All right. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow. Life with its tears.